Let's see, last week, we ended with Romans 3, the book of Joshua. Section 8, introductory remarks, and we looked at the handout for A4, contemporary approaches to the establishment of Israel in Canaan. And we looked through that handout rather quickly, surveying the traditional conquest model, and then the what's called often the modified conquest model, where just the three cities were actually taken and destroyed rather than a host of cities. And then the more contemporary viewpoints in mainstream biblical studies, the migration model and the peasant revolt model. So that's where we stopped last week. That brings us to 3b, we'll begin tonight. In the book of Joshua itself, the entry into Canaan, Joshua 1:1-5:12. You notice there are five subpoints under B. I want to make just a couple very brief comments on 1 and 2, and then spend more time on 3. But 1 under B is Joshua's commission in 1:1-9. Remember the book of Deuteronomy, the covenant renewal in the plains of Moab, one of the prominent features of that was the transition of leadership from Moses to Joshua. And at the end of Deuteronomy chapter 34, Moses dies, and now the successor is the leader, and that successor to Moses is Joshua. So you read in verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you, Joshua, and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. And you notice in that commission that runs down through verse 9. In verse 7, he says to Joshua, be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. That's the Deuteronomic theology. You are obedient, you will be blessed, you will be successful. If you are disobedient, then the covenant curse. Verse 8, do not let the book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. So that's the challenge to Joshua as he gives leadership to the people as they undertake the crossing of the Jordan, the entrance in through the land of Canaan, and eventually the conquest of that land. B, or number 2 under B, is the people are mobilized in chapter 1, verses 10 to 18. That's all on your lecture outline. You notice there in verse 10, Joshua gives instructions, and he orders the officers, go through the camp, tell the people, get your supplies ready. 3 days from now, you will cross the Jordan to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving to you. So the people are mobilized to cross the Jordan, but before actually doing that, you have chapter 2, that tells about the sending of spies across the river in advance of Israel's crossing the river in order to see what the situation was there. And that involves the story of Rahab, the harlot, who gave refuge to those spies and then protected them when the king of Jericho sent his people to try to capture them. Story of Rahab in chapter 2 is one that's attracted a great deal of interest, and from a standpoint of ethics, it has attracted a great deal of discussion as to how to evaluate the conduct of Rahab. Did she do something commendable in misleading the agents of the king of Jericho so that they were not able to capture those spies? Is that commendable, or is that something for which she should be criticized or condemned? Didn't she lie and deceive? I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. But I think, however you read Joshua chapter 2, you should read it in the light of two New Testament texts. The one is Hebrews 11:31, and the other is James 2:25. In Hebrews 11:31, you read in that chapter that recounts a long list of the heroes of faith of the Old Testament period. You read in verse 31, by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. In James 2:25, you read a little more detail about Rahab. After talking about Abraham's faith, verse 25 of James 2 says, in the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? You notice both those texts, I guess it's the Hebrews text, and then you see it in Joshua 2 as well. Speak of Rahab's faith. I think Rahab's faith is the key to the explanation of what she did. If you go back to Joshua chapter 2, verse 3, you read that the king of Jericho sent the message to Rahab, bring out the men who came to you and entered your house because they have come to spy out the whole land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. But then verse 6, parenthetically, tells us what the reality of the situation was. She had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. But then you read down in verse 8 and following something of Rahab's faith. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that Yahweh has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how Yahweh dried up the water of the Red Sea, and that deliverance from the Egyptians, for when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you. Why? For Yahweh, your God, is God in heaven above and on earth below. There's Rahab's faith. She believed that Yahweh was God in heaven and on earth. And her action in giving protection to those spies, I think, is an action that is born of that faith. Now, if you get back to the question of the means that she used to protect them, it's certainly a legitimate topic for discussion. As I mentioned, it's been often discussed. Some find fault with the way in which she protected them. For myself, I would prefer to reserve judgment on her action The Bible makes no criticism of her or no condemnation of her. And what statements there are in the Bible, particularly those New Testament texts, are fairly commendatory, particularly of her faith. But the question arises, what was Rahab's obligation when the king of Jericho sends his people to capture those spies? What was her obligation toward the king of Jericho as well as toward the spies that she was protecting? Did she have an obligation to betray the Hebrew spies to the king of Jericho when asked about their whereabouts? I would say James 2:25 sounds quite positive. James 2:25 says, was not Rahab considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them all a different way? I want to come back to this and spend some time on it just as an illustration of an ethical issue, because it's something I think is worth reflecting on. But before doing that, let me make just a couple more comments about Rahab. She's the only woman in the Old Testament who has the name Rahab. In Matthew 1, verse 5, you have a genealogy of Jesus in that first chapter. And in verse 5 of Matthew 1, you read, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, Jesse, King David. So there is a Rahab, and most think it is this Rahab, who is in the line of descent of Christ himself. There's a Jewish tradition that she, subsequent to the conquest, became a prophetess and eventually married Joshua, and that 8 prophets were among her descendants, including Jeremiah. Now, there's little evidence for any of that. Certainly no biblical evidence for any of that. But her name is included in the genealogy of Christ. Jericho was a city-state with its own king. If you look at Joshua chapter 12, you have a list of the kings and the cities that Joshua and the Israelites conquered in the process of taking the land of Canaan. And in verse 9, you read, the king of Jericho won. In other words, this is the list of the kings. And then the king of Ai won, the king of Jerusalem won, the king of Hebron won. So you have a territory made up of city-states, each with their own king, which fits with what we know from the Amarna letters from that time, where there were these city-states with their own rulers that corresponded with the Pharaoh in Egypt. But what Rahab did in that kind of a social context was a very dangerous thing. In Hammurabi's code, law 109, death is the penalty for not reporting, quote, outlaws. So there's a certain obligation upon citizens of that time to report outlaws. Certainly what she did was something that could have put her own life in jeopardy had she been caught protecting those spies. So she did a courageous thing, and her action, I think, clearly was born of her faith. She believed that Yahweh was the God of heaven and earth. She wanted to identify with that God and with his people rather than with anyone. The ethics of her action is a whole other subject. And I'd like to spend some time talking about that. I think the question the story raises in a broader sense is, the question, are there any conceivable circumstances in which it is permissible to deceive another person? Are there any circumstances in which it is permissible for someone to deceive another person? Now, I might phrase that and insert another element in that question. Are there any conceivable circumstances in which it is permissible or perhaps even obligatory for someone to deceive another person? That kind of heightens the stakes, you might say. Are there situations in which it's your obligation to do something like what Rahab did? Now, it seems to me when you come to that kind of a question, the place to start is to put it in the context of the requirements of the Ninth Commandment. The foundational law, the Ten Commandments, provides the framework, an objective framework for ethics. The Ninth Commandment is, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. What are the implications of the Ninth Commandment? And I'd like to look at that in what it requires and what it forbids. And do that, first of all, with respect to what I would call the specific intent of the Ninth Commandment before looking at its broader intent. But what is the specific intent of the Ninth Commandment? You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. The language of that prohibition, and particularly the phrase bearing false witness, brings us into the sphere of judicial procedure. I think what you find in the second table of the law, that is the commandments 5 through 9, that speak about relationships, horizontal relationships. The first 4 speak about your relationship with God. But beginning with the 5th, honor your father and mother. 6, you shall not kill, murder is forbidden. 7, adultery is forbidden. 8, theft is forbidden. You have these relationships between people. And God protects in the 5th commandment authority in relationships, honor your father and your mother. In the 6th, where murder is forbidden, he protects life. In the 7th, where adultery is forbidden, he protects marriage. In the 8th, where theft is forbidden, he protects possessions. Those are very basic things in the structure of any social organization. So, what he does then in the 9th commandment is provide for enforcement of the other commandments by means of judicial procedure. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So God secures or provides a basis for order and justice in society, not just by giving laws, but also by making provision for the enforcement of those laws by judicial procedure. In other words, there's to be a court of justice, and there are to be officials who provide for the maintenance and restoration of justice in the social order. And in doing that, one of the important features of the procedure is to call for witnesses in order to substantiate charges that might be brought against someone for having broken one of those other commandments. So all of that judicial procedure, I think, is bound up in the wording of the ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness. That bearing false witness, as far as its specific intent, is speaking to this issue of judicial apparatus, where you'd have a judge, someone would make a charge, the judge would call witnesses to establish if the complaint is valid. And an oath would be taken, a decision would be made, a sentence would be given. If you go to Deuteronomy 16, verse 18, as far as the legal background for this, you read in Deuteronomy 16, 18, that judges and officials were to be appointed for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God has given you. They shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Follow justice, and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land the Lord your God has given you. And that was to be done when Israel comes into Canaan. There were to be judges in each town. Look at 2 Chronicles 19, verse 5. You read there of Jehoshaphat. He appointed judges in the land, in each of the fortified cities of Judah. He told them, consider carefully what you do, because you are not judging for man, but for the Lord, who is with you, whenever you give a verdict. Now, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Judge carefully, for with the Lord our God there is no injustice, or partiality, or bribery. Now, as I've mentioned, there was to be this judicial procedure. That procedure rested on witnesses to establish the facts. Go back to Deuteronomy this time, 19, verse 15 and follow. There you read, one witness is not enough to convict a man accused of any crime or offense he may have committed. The matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So there's a procedure there to make certain that a mistake is not made. You need two or three witnesses to establish someone's guilt. But notice where it goes from here, and that brings us back into the wording of the ninth commandment. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse a man of a crime, the two men involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who were in office at that time. The judges must make a thorough investigation. And if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony — false testimony is the same as the wording in the Hebrew, same as the wording of the ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor — if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false witness against his brother, then do to him as he intended to do to his brother. You must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid. So you see, bearing false witness was an extremely serious business, because bearing false witness could cause injustice, and God is concerned with justice. And it's interesting, the provision here is if somebody is found out to really be a false witness, whatever he had accused that other person of, whatever the crime might have been, he himself would bear the penalty for that crime, because he bore false witness. I remember some years ago reading of a case, I think somewhere in the Midwest, where someone had — a woman had accused a man of molesting or raping her. The man had been convicted. He'd been put in jail. He'd served 10 or 15 years. And then later it turned out, evidence came up, I don't know if it was DNA or what, that he was innocent of it. Well, he'd given 10 years of his life on the basis of a false witness. Now, as far as I know, the woman who charged him with that never really had to suffer anything. No. She didn't serve the penalty he did. Our judicial system, I don't think, works that way. But that's the way it works here in Deuteronomy. Bearing false witness was a serious business. I think what you find is, in human history generally, God has made this provision, don't bear false witness in this context of judicial procedure, but fallen human beings often turn the system on its head and attempt to use the judicial system in opposition to its intended purpose. God gives the procedure to assure every person of justice and protection, and often people attempt to use the procedure to cause injustice. That's why this command, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Let me give you another Old Testament example. 1 Kings 21:9. This is the chapter that describes Ahab's seizing of the vineyard of Naboth. And it's kind of an interesting story. Ahab, as you remember, was married to Jezebel, who was from Phoenicia, a worshiper of Baal and Asherah. And verse 4 of 1 Kings 21 says, when Naboth refused to sell his vineyard to Ahab, you read verse 4, he went home, that is Ahab did, sullen and angry, because Naboth has said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. He lay in his bed, sulking, and refused to eat. His wife Jezebel came in and asked, why are you so sullen? Why won't you eat? He answered her, because I said to Naboth the Jezreelite, sell me your vineyard, or if you prefer, I will give you another vineyard in its place. He said, I will not give you my vineyard. Jezebel said, is this how you act as king over Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite. So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him. And those letters she wrote, proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people, but seat, notice, two scoundrels opposite him and have them testify that he is cursed, both God and the king. In other words, have them bear false witness. Then take him out and stone him to death. So the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city did as Jezebel directed in the letter she had written to them. They proclaimed a fast, seated Naboth in a prominent place. Then two scoundrels came, sat opposite him, and brought charges against Naboth before the people, saying, Naboth has cursed both God and the king. That's bearing false witness in a judicial procedure, which resulted in injustice. Naboth is taken out and put to death. Look at Matthew 26:59. There you read when Jesus is before the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. An attempt to subvert judicial procedure so that injustice, rather than justice, prevailed. So I think if you get back to where we started with this, you place Rahab's actions initially in the context of the provisions of the Ninth Commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. The Ninth Commandment specifically is speaking about judicial procedure and the way in which a person's words should cause justice rather than injustice to prevail with respect to their neighbor. As far as the broader intent of the Ninth Commandment, I think certainly it has a broader intent, broader implications. Certainly in its broader intent, it goes beyond the limits of the letter with its function in the judicial setting. I think the spirit or broader sense of the commandment is that it requires that we serve our neighbor with our witness for our words, so that our words will not cause injustice to come on our neighbor. In other words, the just due of our neighbor should be secured and protected by our words, not only before a court of law, but in everyday life. Very easy to slander someone, to circulate rumors about someone that injures them and their reputation. It's even possible to speak the quote truth about someone out of season. In other words, perhaps spread some information that may be true about someone's past, something that's no longer relevant, that damages the reputation of that person. I think that's a violation of this commandment. But there are cases in which application of the Ninth Commandment becomes difficult. And I think that's where we come to the kind of situation that Rahab was in. And we come to the question, is it ever permissible to deceive another person in order to avoid injustice being brought on our neighbor? Now, having said that, often that question will be formulated in a more blunt or direct way. Is it ever permissible to lie? Isn't that what Rahab did? You go back to Joshua chapter 2. The agents from the king come in. She says, yes, they did. But they left. I don't know which way they went. But she put them up on the roof and didn't. So if you formulate the question, is it ever permissible to lie? And then look at the way that has been answered. I think there are basically four responses that I've come across to that question. And let me go through them quickly and then we'll discuss them a bit. Is it ever permissible to lie? Some would say no. Without exception, it is never permissible. And that response would say Rahab acted wrong in what she did because she lied. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, is it ever permissible to lie? Would answer yes. But answer yes in the context of what is normally called a situation ethic, in which it is argued there is no objective standard of morality. You must determine right or wrong in any given situation by application of the law of love. A man named Joseph Fletcher many years ago wrote a book called Situation Ethics, and that was the basic position he argued for. There is no objective standard of conduct. You just apply the law of love in whatever situation, wherever that leads you, that is the answer. I think that position's in conflict with biblical norms, because certainly the Ten Commandments are an objective standard of morality. There is an objective standard of morality. But that's the other end of the spectrum. A third position, is it ever permissible to lie? The response of a third position would be yes, but with qualification. Only under extreme circumstances in which there is a clash of obligations and the advocates of this view would say there are certain extreme circumstances in which there is a clash of obligations, and in such a situation, the spirit of the Ninth Commandment takes priority over some formal statement corresponding to reality. In other words, a formal statement of, quote, truth. Clash of obligations, spirit of the Ninth Commandment takes priority over some kind of formal statement of, quote, truth. I'll come back and we'll discuss that further. Mm-hmm. A fourth response, is it ever permissible to lie? The answer here would be no. But then proceed to redefine lie in order to allow for situations in which speaking or intimating what is not true is not a lie, at least not by definition. Now, you can say that's just semantics. Well, maybe. We'll come back to that one and look at it too. But those, I think, are the four positions. Ever permissible lie? No. Never. Or then go to situation ethics. There is no objective standard of morality. Apply the law of law. Third, clash of circumstances. Or clash of obligations in certain extreme circumstances where the spirit of the Ninth Commandment takes priority over its letter. Or the fourth one is ever permissible to lie? No, but then redefine why. To allow for situations in which not speaking the truth is not considered a lie, at least not by definition. I want to go to view three first. Is it ever permissible to lie? Yes, but only where there's this clash of obligations and the spirit of the Ninth Commandment has priority over a formal statement of truth. Now, it's interesting, you see, if we're putting this in the context of the Ninth Commandment, the Ninth Commandment is worded differently than thou shalt not lie. That's not what it says. Ninth Commandment says you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. I think what we need to notice there is that in the formulation of the Ninth Commandment, this is not an abstract kind of commandment, you shall not lie. It's a formulation in which the neighbor is involved. You may not bring injury to your neighbor by your speaking. I think that wording puts a different slant on the commandment than a simple impersonal prohibition against lying. It's not that. It's a prohibition in which there is another person involved. Its essence is you may not damage your neighbor with your words. I think you can say there are three elements involved. There's you, your neighbor, and the situation, And all three of those, here's God, are under God. And here's this circle. A certain situation involves you and your neighbor. We call this situation reality. So you have those three elements, you, your neighbor, and reality, all before the face of God. And what God, I think, generally asks us is when we speak, to keep both the reality as well as the neighbor in view. You can't deny the reality for the sake of the neighbor, but you can't deny your neighbor for the sake of the reality. There's where you get the conflict of obligation. And sometimes you find situations in which you get a conflict between the obligation to the neighbor and the obligation to speak about what the reality is. And then the question is, are there situations in which we must consider our obligation to our neighbor as a higher obligation than our witness to reality? And the advocates of this third position would say that the person who says that in every situation we are bound to some formal statement corresponding to reality has really separated the letter of the law, that is, of the Ninth Commandment, from its spirit or its intent, and may actually violate the command by holding to it in this rigidly formal way. In other words, holding to the letter of the law actually violates the spirit or the intent of the law. I think we should certainly keep in mind that the spirit of the law can't be separated from the letter. But the reverse is also true. The letter should not be separated from the spirit. And what you have here is speaking truth in relationship, because there's another person involved, rather truth in the abstract. So, advocates of that third position would say, is it ever permissible to lie? Yes. But only in extreme circumstances in which there's this kind of clash of obligations, in which our word should serve that justice come to our neighbor rather than injustice. Thus, someone like Rahab was completely justified and obeying the spirit or the intent of the Ninth Commandment by doing what she did. Now, let's go on to the fourth view. Fourth view, is it ever permissible lie? No, but then redefine lie. Look at your citations, page 46. And over onto page 47. This is taken from Charles Hodges' Systematic Theology in his discussion of the Ten Commandments, and here specifically his discussion of the Ninth Commandment. I might say his discussion of the Ten Commandments is very useful. It's rather lengthy and detailed, but that volume 3 of his Systematic Theology is very helpful as far as exposition of the obligations, requirements, and duties of the Ten Commandments. Notice what he says. He says, intention to deceive is an element in the idea of falsehood. But even this is not always culpable. When Pharaoh commanded the Hebrew midwives to slay the male children of their countrywomen, they disobeyed him. And when called to account for their disobedience, they said, The Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered. They are the midwives coming unto them. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives. And the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. In 1 Samuel 16, 1 and 2, which is quite interesting, we'll come back to this a little, we read that God said to Samuel, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? Saul here had any more children. Remember, 1 Samuel 16, Saul had been rejected as king at 15, and now God is sending David to anoint Saul's replacement. And he says, go there and do that. And Samuel says, if Saul hears about it, he'll kill me. The Lord said, take a heifer with thee and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. Here it is said, is a case of an intentional deception actually commanded. Saul was to be deceived as to the object of Saul's journey to Bethlehem. Still more marked is the conduct of Elisha, as recorded in 2 Kings 6, 14 to 20. The king of Syria sent soldiers to seize the prophet of Dothan. And when they came down to him, Elisha prayed unto the Lord and said, smite this people, I pray thee, with blindness. And he smote them with blindness, according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said unto them, this is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, I will bring you to the man whom you seek. But he led them to Samaria. And it came to pass, when they were come to Samaria, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men, they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they are in the midst of Samaria. That is, in the hands of their enemies. The prophet, however, would not allow them to be injured, but commanded that they should be fed and sent back to their master. Examples of this kind of deception are numerous in the Old Testament. Some of them are simply recorded facts, without anything to indicate how they were regarded in the sight of God. But others, as in the cases cited above, received either directly or by implication divine sanction. Now, his comments on these kinds of situations. It is the general sentiment among moralists that stratagems in war are allowable. That it is lawful not only to conceal intended movements from an enemy, but also to mislead him as to your intention. A great part of the skill of a military commander is evinced in detecting the intentions of his adversary concealing his own. That's a pretty common procedure in military strategies. You know, that first Iraq war, they had all these Marines offshore and ships where it looked like they were going to invade and from a certain direction, and they came around from the other side. Which is a common thing. Few men would be so scrupulous, this is going further, as to refuse to keep a light in a room when robbery was apprehended with the purpose of producing the impression that the members of the household were on the alert. Now, it's interesting, Hodge uses that as an illustration. We live in a time where you have these timers that you can set. So if you're going away for a week, every night your lights come on for when it gets dark and go off at 10 or 11 o'clock. I don't know if you do that. We've occasionally done it. What's the purpose? Well, I think it's what he says here. If you want to deceive people into thinking you're home, is there something ethically or morally wrong with doing that? On these grounds, it's generally admitted that in criminal falsehoods, there must be not only an enunciation or signification of what is false and an intention to deceive, but also a violation of some obligation. If there may be any combination of circumstances under which a man is not bound to speak the truth, those to whom the declaration or signification is made have no right to expect him to do so. A general is under no obligation to reveal his intended movements to his adversary. His adversary has no right to suppose his apparent intention is his real purpose. Elisha was under no obligation to aid the Syrians in securing his person, taking his life. They have no right to assume he would thus assist them, and therefore he did no wrong in misleading them. There will always be cases in which the rule of duty is a matter of death. It's often said the rule above stated applies when a robber demands your purse. It is said to be right to deny that you have anything of value without you. You are not bound to aid him in committing a crime. He has no right to assume that you will facilitate the accomplishment of his object. Now, that's an interesting case. Notice Hodges' comment. This is not so true. The obligation to speak the truth is very solemn. And when the choice is left a man to tell a lie or lose his money, we'd better let his money go. On the other hand, now you get into a different context. If a mother sees a murderer in pursuit of her child, she has a perfect right to mislead him by any means in her power. Because the general obligation to speak the truth is merged or lost for the time being in the higher obligation. In other words, the life of your child is at stake. You have no obligation to help the person that wants to take that life. You have every obligation to do whatever you can to protect that child. Hodge says this principle is not invalidated by its possible or actual abuse. It can easily be abused. You see, that's where you have to weigh things and know, be careful how you draw these lines. It has been greatly abused. Jesuits taught that the obligation to promote the good of the church absorbed or superseded every other obligation. And therefore, in their system, not only falsehood, mental reservation, but perjury, robbery, assassination became lawful if committed with the design of promoting the interests of the church. Interesting. Notwithstanding this liability to abuse, the principle that a higher obligation absolves from a lower stands firm. Now, at that point, you see, you're back into this. Answer three, higher obligation, clash of obligations. There are gradations of obligations. But notice where he goes further, and this is what distinguishes Hodge's position from number three. The question now under consideration is not whether it is ever right to do wrong, which is a solecism, nor is the question whether it is ever right to lie, but rather, what constitutes a lie? It's not simply an enunciatio falsi, false statement. But there must be an intention to deceive when we are expected and bound to speak the truth. That is, there are circumstances in which a man is not bound to speak the truth, and therefore there are cases in which speaking or intimating what is not true is not a lie. That's the essence, you see, of Hodges' position. It is far better that a man should die or permit a murder to be committed than that he should sin against God. Nothing could tempt the Christian martyrs to save their own lives or the lives of their brethren by denying Christ or by professing to believe in false gods. In these cases, the obligation to speak the truth was in full force. But in the case of a commanding general in the time of war, the obligation does not exist to intimate his true intentions to his adversary. Intentional deception in his case is not moral, a falsehood. So is it ever permissible to tell a lie? We put it that way, Hodge would say, no, it isn't. But then you redefine what a lie is to allow for situations in which intimating something is not true or speaking something is not true is not by definition considered what.
So what if Abraham?
Well, you'd have to weigh that. You know, he was doing that
you could probably argue, to protect the life of his wife and himself. Not so much his wife, but of himself. Protect her from the perils. There's no comment on that. There's no comment on that. We'll come back to some of these other places. I'm going to go to the first view. Is it ever permissible to lie? No, without exception. I'd say probably the strongest current advocate of that first viewpoint is Walter Kaiser. That's his response in his volume Toward Old Testament Ethics. And in his discussion of this question, Kaiser finds fault with Rahab, as well as with the Hebrew midwives in their response to the Pharaoh. He rests much of his argument on the distinction he makes, following the definition of another man, we'll see in our citations in a minute, but a distinction he makes between what he terms concealing and lying. In other words, permissible, he would argue, in certain situations to conceal something from another person, but it's never permissible to lie to another person. As far as Rahab is concerned, and those New Testament texts, he says Rahab is commended for her faith, not for her lying. Look at page 49 of your citations. Paragraph that begins at the middle of page 49, actually, this material begins over on page 47, but I want to look at page 49 first. Middle paragraph, he says, the issue at stake in the case of the midwives and Rahab is whether God recognizes and approves of otherwise dubious methods that are alien to the integrity of his character and fulfilling the purpose of his will. Can strong faith coexist and be actuated by the infirmities of unbelief? It is true that Hebrews 11:31 includes Rahab as a woman of faith. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Likewise, James 2:25, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? But, here's his comment, the areas of Rahab's faith must be strictly observed. It was not her lying that won her divine recognition. Rather, it was her faith. She believed in the Lord God of the Hebrews and God's action in Israel's exodus more than she was frightened by the king of Jericho. The evidence of her faith was seen in the works of receiving the spies and sending them out another way. Thus, she was well within the proprieties of biblical ethics, such as mirroring the holiness and character of God when she hid the spies and took the legitimate precaution of sending them out another way. But her lying, at least in Kaiser's opinion, was an unnecessary accoutrement to both of the above approved responses. That's a good question. That's about all she could say if she's going to tell the truth. And then you get into the question, is that not tempting God? Hold that question for a moment. We can come back to it, because there are other examples. You know, Corrie ten Boom would not lie. She would expect God to intervene. Brother Andrew, smuggling Bibles, would not lie. And he would expect God to win again. So hold that question for a minute. The last paragraph on 49 about the Hebrew midwives, you notice what Tizer says. While we agree that Pharaoh has given up the right to know all the facts and that this could be a legitimate case, a case of legitimate concealment of facts, just as in the case of Saul and Samuel, we cannot agree that the midwives had any right to lie. Pharaoh does not deserve to know all the truth, but the midwives owe it to God to speak only the truth. If they truly had not made even one Hebrew male delivery during the months of Pharaoh's new program, then their response was laudable and justified by Old Testament ethics. However, if they were partially true and partially telling a lie, they were just as blameworthy as Rahab, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob when they lied. There's the Abraham in Kaiser's case. Now, what we've read those paragraphs from Tizer, and what I mentioned earlier was his view is really based on this distinction he makes between lying and concealment. Go back to page 48. And you see about a quarter of the way down the page, he says, Mahan, Asa Mahan, commented on this definition in the following manner, and he's quoting from Mayer. He says, the deception must be intentional, else guilt does not attach to the agent, or the crime falls under some other denomination than lying. The person or persons deceived must have a claim to know the truth, if anything is communicated, else no obligations are violated in the act of deception. And then the next several sentences. Lying should be carefully distinguished from concealing. It is proper to conceal facts from individuals whom we have no right to deceive. Concealment is a sin when and only when an obligation exists to reveal the fact which is concealed. So that's the distinction he makes. Skip the next paragraph, go down to the one after that, middle of the page. He says, the importance of this definition can be seen in those instances where concealment was present without it being a moral evil. Thus, Mahan teaches that concealment is proper, or even a duty, when it does not violate a moral obligation. Several instances will illustrate what types of situations these are. Concealment is demanded when the person from whom the truth is withheld has forfeited his or her right or has no legitimate claim to that truth. And here's how he understands 1 Samuel 16. That was Saul's position in 1 Samuel 16, 1-3. Having been instructed by God to fill your horn with oil and go on your way, I am sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I have chosen one of his sons to be king. But Samuel said, how can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me. The Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Now notice the comment on that in the next paragraph. Without question, opined John Murray, here is divine authorization for concealment by means of a statement other than that which would have disclosed the main purpose of Samuel's visit to Jesse. But it is just as important to note that Samuel had no special prerogative to speak a falsehood either. The only point that may legitimately be made is that concealment in some situations is not lying. Only what was true was presented to Saul. As for Saul's ultimate intentions, nothing is affirmed or denied, and nothing incited Saul's mind to probe concerning what may have been Saul's ultimate motives for coming to Bethlehem at this time. Had such questions been raised, an altogether different problem would have confronted Samuel. He would
have to avoid either affirming or denying what those purposes were or face the wrath of Saul's disclosure. I think Kaiser's making here a distinction without a difference. Yes, Samuel did sacrifice when he went there. But what the Lord instructs him, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. What's the purpose of that? Of course, this is all, in a certain sense, hypothetical, because Saul didn't ask him. But had he asked, and Samuel had responded, I am going to Bethlehem to offer a sacrifice. Isn't that deception? Isn't the purpose to deceive? And you might say, technically, he was speaking the truth. Yes, he did sacrifice, but at the same time, he deceived. Or he would have deceived had he been asked, and that was his response. And the Lord instructed him, I would say, not just to conceal, but to deceive. So you can ask that question about 1 Samuel 16. Is God's command to Samuel just intended to conceal or also to deceive? Seems to me, had the question been asked, and had Saul, had Samuel done what the Lord instructed him to do, the result would be deception. Saul would think he was going there to offer sacrifice and not be anointed as a king. So I'm not sure that distinction is as helpful as Kaiser suggests that it is. Now, question was asked, about what Rahab should have said, you know? And I mentioned that Corrie ten Boom hid many refugees. This is from an article that's in your bibliography. Was Rahab's lie a sin by who's afraid? Peter Barnes, it's in your bibliography. And he speaks of Corrie ten Boom. He says that ten Boom's hid many refugees, notably Jews, escaping from Nazi tyranny. Corrie ten Boom considered that she should not lie, even to save those who were hiding from the Gestapo. She maintained that God honors truth-telling with perfect protection. Hence, she advocated telling the Gestapo the truth, no matter how many Jewish lives were thereby in danger. On this view, Rahab should have told the truth and trusted that God would protect the two Israelite spies by some means of his own. Now, I think that, you know, if you were going to argue for always telling the truth, without exception, you would have to say, Rahab should have said they're up on the roof and then expect that, in those words, God would protect them by some means of his own. J.I. Packer suggests, you know, what I think is a better approach. Rahab may not have broken the ninth commandment, as she was not bearing false witness against her neighbor, but in his favor. In other words, her words were to bring justice to her neighbor rather than injustice. Rushduni says if Rahab told the truth, as Corrie ten Boom did, she would have become guilty of the sin of testing God.
He sees a parallel to the devil's temptation to Christ, urging him to leap off the pinnacle of the temple because God had promised his angels would protect his people. To leap from the top of the temple would have been to seek an unsolicited, useless miracle from God. So it gets complex. There's a lot of ramifications to this. I mentioned Brother Andrew with his Bible smuggling. And in a review of his book by this book called The Ethics of Smuggling, a review by Greg Bonson, he says one of the weaknesses of the book is the attempt to maintain that his activity of smuggling is not a deviation from truth telling. Andrew apparently feels compelled to argue he does not lie when he smuggles in Bibles. There are two things which must be said here. First, Andrew should feel no compulsion to defend himself against the observation that he is not telling the truth, as Scripture ordinarily requires, nor should he feel that he must draw back from overtly lying to border guards. In Andrew's discussion of this, he gets back into this distinction between concealing and lying. He says you must be careful to guard the distinction between concealment and lying. As far as my own ministry is concerned, I will never tell a lie. I pray mighty hard that I don't have to tell the truth either. In his last chapter, he explains he always tells the truth, but sometimes concealing a relevant part of it. Sometimes saying things for which the guards will have a different interpretation. In other words, deceiving them. Now, I think such behavior could be morally justified if we were permitted to deviate from telling the truth under special circumstances. But it is fatuous to argue that such behavior is consistent with telling the truth. If Andrew intends to deceive his hearer, he has not told the truth in the way Scripture ordinarily requires. By willingly misleading his hearer through his tactics, he has as much luck as luck. So it's an interesting ethical question and complex. I've spent this time on it simply because I think it's something you ought to think about and try to sort through, although I'd add this caution. Almost all these examples, whether from Scripture or otherwise, are in the context of abusive totalitarian kinds of governments or conditions of war. Living in this country, I don't think most of us bump up against these kinds of issues very often. You were living in communist China, or some other places of similar political, totalitarian, oppressive governments, particularly as a Christian, you probably live with these kinds of ethical dilemmas pretty constantly, and you have to think about it and work through them. I might say my wife, who was reared, lived in Holland as a child, during the German occupation of the Netherlands. And she remembers well the German soldiers marching through Amsterdam and randomly shooting people. And her parents harbored some Jewish people in their house during that time. Her parents are not living anymore. So I think I know them well enough, so she probably backed me up on this. One of those German soldiers knocked on their front door, like a Rayette thing, and asked if they had a person hiding in the house. They would not have opened the door and said, yeah, they're hiding here in the closet. And expected God to intervene. They wouldn't have done that. They would have felt, I'm certain, their responsibility was to protect that person with their words. And if that meant misleading or deceiving those German soldiers. So then, the higher obligation. No obligation, fellas. So, questions, comments? Yeah.
A lot of times in this discussion, people bring up the powerful procedures.
Mm-hmm.
They seem like you call them to deceive on purpose. Are you going to discuss that at all?
Wow.
It comes out a lot. And that's not in the time where he was protecting people from the California.
All right. Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of that debate, but. That's an interesting discussion. Related to other theological issues of the hardening of men's hearts and so forth, I would think.
That's
an
idea for that.
Oh, okay. Well, you can mix this discussion in with that thing. Okay. Well, let's go on. Let's go a little bit further. That was all under B3, sending of the spies to Jericho. 4 is crossing the Jordan. And that's Joshua 3:1-5. Israel was faced with a very dangerous thing. And that is, they had to cross a river in order to enter the land of Canaan. Crossing the river under a military sort of situation puts someone at great disadvantage. You notice in verse 2 of chapter 3, they're encamped there by the Jordan for 3 days. And if you go down further in the chapter, verse 15, you read the Jordan is at flood stage during all the harvest. And that was the time. So here they are encamped by the Jordan, looking at this barrier to entrance into the land of Canaan. The river is in flood stage. I don't know how many of you have seen the Jordan. I was there many years ago, and it wasn't at flood stage. It was in the dry season. And, you hear the song about the mighty Jordan rolling. Didn't look like the mighty Jordan. It looked like a small creek. But at flood stage, I'm sure it looks quite different because the rainy season there, the water just pours off that kind of soil and flats and crosses. So Israel had to cross the Jordan. A difficult thing to do, but the Lord gives a sign. Notice verse 10 and following. Verse 9, Joshua says to the Israelites, come here, listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will surely drive out the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Verse 13, as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. So the Lord tells Joshua and the people through Joshua that that's what will happen. And in verse 16 or 15b, you read, as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap. A great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan. Now, Zarethan's about 20 miles north of where Israel was crossing the Jordan. Israel was crossing the Jordan opposite Jericho. And about 20 miles north, the flow of the river was blocked. So the water ceased flowing down where the Israelites were. But that was timed precisely to when the priests picked up the ark and started moving toward the Jordan River, so that it was completely cut off and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. If you have an NIV study Bible, there's a note there on verse 13 where it says, the waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. And the note says, Hebrew for heap is found here in verse 16 also. It's possible God used a physical means such as a landslide to dam up the Jordan at a place called Adam near the entrance of the Jabbok. As recently as 1927, a blockage of water in this area was recorded. It lasted over 20 hours. But if so, the miraculous element is not diminished. In that area, the Jordan runs through a narrow chasm with walls on either side. And there have been more than one example where landslides there are related to earthquakes or whatever have blocked the Jordan River. Well, it may well have been an incident of that sort that occurred. But as this note says, the miraculous element's not diminished. The Lord used that and timed that precisely in the way to fulfill what he had said, and to enable them to cross. So that's chapter 3. In chapter 4, Joshua is instructed to get 12 stones, one for each tribe, and to make a monument to this deliverance of the Lord of the Israelites as they were enabled to cross the Jordan River. And you read in verse 4, Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, said to them, go before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you in the future when your children ask, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. So here's a visual reminder of what the Lord had done. When you go down to verse 21 in the chapter, when those 12 stones are set up, Joshua says, in the future, when your descendants ask their fathers what do these stones mean, tell them Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we crossed over. And then notice 24. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of Yahweh was powerful, and so that you might always fear Yahweh, your God. You're back into the same sort of theme you had with the plagues at the time of Exodus, that the Egyptians might know that I am Yahweh, that Israel may know that I am Yahweh. And here is another incident of a similar sort. So God is again demonstrating his existence and his power. And I might say the other thing that is kind of a parallel here with what you had at the time of the crossing of the Red Sea is that as Moses' leadership was authenticated at that time, so Joshua's leadership is authenticated here in a similar way to what it was at the time of the Exodus. You notice in 3:7, the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. And over in 4:14, that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel. They revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. You see, that's much like Exodus 14:31, where after the deliverance through the Red Sea, we read, when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses' servants. And now, just as that happened with Moses, here it does with Joshua. Let's go on to five, and then we'll take a break. Five is circumcision and the encampment at Gilgal, chapter 5, verses 2 to 12. I might say verse 1 of chapter 5 tells us how it is that Israel could, immediately upon entering the land of Canaan, circumcise the males who had not been circumcised during the wilderness period, as well as observe the Passover without being attacked by the Canaanites. You see, what the first verse says is, when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan, all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until we had crossed over, their hearts melted. They no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. So, the will of the Canaanites to resist was removed by fear. And it seems to me that God caused that to be so in order that Israel's initial days in the Promised Land could be spent in worship and covenant renewal rather than in war. The war would come. But there were some more important things needed to be done before Israel engaged in battle. And the first thing was all the males who had not been circumcised during the 38 years in the wilderness were now to be circumcised. Seems clear that circumcision had not been practiced during the wilderness period. So you read in verse 2, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives, circumcise the Israelites again. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites. Now this is why he did so. All those who came out of Egypt, all the men of military age, died in the desert on the way after leaving Egypt. All the people that came out had been circumcised. But all the people born in the desert during the journey from Egypt had not. So for 40 years, you have a generation that had not been circumcised. And Joshua is commanded to do it. Now, question arises, why weren't all of those males circumcised according to the regulations of the Mosaic law during the wilderness period? There's no direct explanation of that. If you look at Numbers 14:34, I think you can, and there's a reference in Psalm 95 as well, but 14:34, that's after the spies went up from Kadesh Barnea and came back and said, we can't conquer the land, the Lord condemned them to the 38 years more in the wilderness, and says, for 14:34, for 40 years, 1 year for each of the 40 days you explored the land, you will suffer for your sins, and then notice the next phrase, and know what it is like to have me against you. So, for that 38-year period, Israel was under the Lord's judgment. You will know what it is like to have me against you. Look at Psalm 95:9. Reflecting back on this, well, that 95:9 speaks of Meribah and Massah, where your fathers tested and tried me. But then verse 10. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declare an oath, my anger, they shall never enter my rest. Seems that Israel was under God's judgment for that 38-year period, and perhaps for that reason, although there's no explicit statement of this, applying the sign of the covenant, circumcision, was not appropriate and was not done. But the Lord is explicit here, now it is to be done, and so the new generation is circumcised in Joshua chapter 5. And then the Passover is observed. Verse 10, on the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal in the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. Apparently, the Passover as well had not been observed since the second year of the wilderness wandering. In Numbers chapter 9, remember we talked about that. There was an observance of the Passover, and there were some who were ritually unclean, couldn't observe it, and provision was made so that they could at a later period of time. But apart from that Numbers 9 reference to observance of the Passover, second year after the Exodus, while Israel was still at Sinai, there's no further reference to observance of the Passover. Of course, the Passover could not be observed by those who were uncircumcised, because being uncircumcised would make them ritually unclean. Look at Exodus 12:43 in part. The Lord said to Moses, these are the regulations for the Passover. No foreigners to eat of it. Any slave you have bought may eat of it after you have circumcised them. Down at the end of verse 48, no uncircumcised male may eat of it. Same law applies to native born and the alien living among you. If you're uncircumcised, you may not partake of the Passover. So there was a generation that hadn't been circumcised. There's also a generation that hadn't observed the Passover. So God provides here, it seems to me, for a renewal of covenant fellowship with his people immediately upon entrance into the promised land. And he wants to assure them that he is their covenant God. He wants to encourage them as they face the coming battles that very shortly they will be engaged in.